My name's Hayden Prowse.
I'm Julian Rubenstein.
And this is News Roast, in which Julian and I get a guest on to talk about stuff.
It's a really good forum for a deep dive into issues that affect or our guests are super interested in. We've had some amazing ones on before, but today we are massively honoured, hyped, to be joined by someone I think we both massively admire.
A mate of ours, and also someone we greatly admire. It's Hassan Aked.
Hey, guys.
Hey,
and Hassan, so a little bit of background. Hassan, I met Hassan, 2 years ago now?
Yeah, 2 years ago.
2 years ago. Because he was part of Help Refugees, which is a charity we're both involved with. And he had done this incredible thing, which we're going to talk about in a minute, where he'd been in Syria, living in Syria. And I'll let you go into it properly because I want people to hear it from you. But he'd made the journey from Syria by boat and land. Everything that you've seen in the newspapers and all the documentaries, he made that journey and he filmed it all on GoPro. So this
like
guy,
a piece of branded content.
Like a Red Bull viral video. He had the foresight to strap a GoPro to his head whilst he was in a sinking dinghy in the Med. And he got to the UK and he became intimately involved in the charity Help Refugees. And he also made a documentary called Exodus, which went out on BBC, which is incredible if you haven't watched it.
BAFTA winning. Director.
Right.
Absolutely extraordinary. Usually I give, because we know you, Hass, it's like, I'm not giving the massive big up, but I think I'm going to do it now. Extraordinary director. Superhuman. Actually, hilarious guy and good fun at Glastonbury.
Great fun at Glastonbury.
Great time at Glastonbury, actually,
So this was the weird thing for you, is you made this documentary and then you ultimately found yourself on the stage at BAFTA.
Yeah, making acceptance speech on the BAFTA stage. Yeah. That was quite surreal.
That must have been weird, man. What was that, a year and
coming
a half?
Coming over here, stealing our BAFTAs.
Coming over here, stealing our BAFTAs. But that was how, like a year and a half after you left the war zone?
Yeah, a year and a half after I arrived in the UK,
After you arrived in the UK. Like 2 years or 2.5 years after you'd left Syria.
Let's rewind and tell a bit of the story, sort of how, you know, how it came about, because you know you were quite vocal in Syria, and just kind of like paint a picture for us and for our listeners.
Mainly the reason why I wanted to film my journey and to film my story fleeing Syria is because I was shocked by the amount of ignorance online from people in the West not understanding why people are leaving the Middle East. People didn't understand what's going on, people didn't know what the push factors are, and people had a lot of questions, understandably. So I was like, all right, so I'm going to film my story. I'm going to tell my story, hoping that people will understand. I'm from Syria, from Damascus, as you guys know. And Syria is the most well-documented geopolitical situation in the world, crisis in the world. It's been on the news for almost 6 years now since revolution started in 2011. It got really messy. It was the Arab Spring waving through the Middle East, from Tunisia to Egypt to Libya, all the way to Syria. Turned into a ferocious war. It was a year and a half of peaceful protesting against the Assad regime.
Which you were intimately
involved
in.
Which I was involved in, and I was filming, and I was...
Filming the protests and the violence against...
Exactly, And so I was 23, and we were that generation of, like, millennials who wanted to protest against one of the... I mean, the Assad regime is quite infamous for their atrocities. And literally what we did is, like, just organizing ourselves on Facebook, setting Facebook groups, sending WhatsApp messages to people, and like organizing protests, understanding the consequences that we're going to go through. Because before Bashar, there was Hafez, his father, who had ruled for 3 decades. And through Hafez's time, there was an uprising in the 80s. Our family members and our friends were involved in that, and we knew what happened to them. They ended up rotting in Palmyra prison for like decades.
So you knew what you were getting yourself into.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. We were like, we can do it. We are the new generation. We have that movement. We can
That's
beat
amazing,
them.
Amazing, man. So it was almost like you were part of a sort of, it was a scene almost.
Exactly.
It was a youth
Absolutely. It was this youth movement, as you're saying, that we're going to beat Assad.
That's incredible.
Yeah, we're going to turn Syria from a dictatorship into a civil democracy.
Because it had happened in countries nearby.
Exactly,
and you felt
it
like
happened.
It was possible.
Yeah, yeah. And people, like, we were like, all right, so the West bailed Egypt out. They supported Tunisia. They supported Libya. And we were like hoping that we will get the same support. And it'll happen. We will win. But.
And what were the tactics? So you were organizing protests. You were filming a lot of the stuff.
And you need to understand something. So that's something that it was much of a culture shock when I arrived here. I mean, here I was shocked that you can go out and protest and say, like, fuck Theresa May or like whatever, fuck the government. For us, I mean, when I saw people doing that and like police officers just smiling at protests, I was like, oh my God. Because for us, going on a protest in Syria is like you're signing your death wish.
Yeah.
Because the longest protest was like 10 minutes in Damascus.
Wow.
And then the Secret Service arrives and they start shooting everybody.
You experienced that.
I've experienced that myself. So you the longest protest is 10 minutes.
10 minutes.
And then you have to run for your life.
So for the listeners, you were filming this stuff and this violence and this shooting.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were sending this
footage to media outlets.
Which?
Like Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya through like mediums, through other people.
And how would you do that? Because that was quite dangerous to do that.
You have to download a VPN because everything is tracked.
Virtual private network.
Yeah. And send them to someone outside of Syria and then they'll get them like your friend outside of Syria. And then they'll send them to them. And we honestly were so hopeful. I mean, aside from how dangerous it was, but we had that vision. We were like, we're gonna changing history. We're changing our country to the best. But for me personally, it all went south when late 2011, early 2012, when I got caught protesting and filming. And that's when, like, reality hit me hard in the face.
What happened then? So these acts of civil disobedience, I mean, it's quite mind-blowing thinking, you know, a 10-minute protest.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about that in the UK and groups of people
and you start
really
getting shot at.
Totally. And putting themselves in real harm's way.
We're not talking about tear gas. We're not talking about water cannons. We're talking about AK-47s, Jesus. Live ammunition being shot at people saying freedom, liberty, Shabir Skat Nizam, which is a very famous slogan. The people want the removal of the regime. And it started in Dara, basically, in the city in the south, where kids wrote a graffiti on the wall demanding the removal of Assad. These kids were tortured. The story went out, went viral, and then just protests were viral throughout all of Syria until like it started in Damascus, in the capital.
Mm. So did someone just cut? They come and swept in while you were filming?
We were protesting. It was Ramadan. It was the holy month of Ramadan. We took advantage of prayers because there are so many stupid laws in Syria. One of them is a congregation of more than three people is illegal in Syria.
Wow.
So what about prayers?
So that was a loophole.
That was a loophole.
We go to a mosque then you're leaving the mosque. There's like hundreds of us. So you just start it and people are like, get involved. So we set up a Facebook group again. We decided which mosque we were going to go to. And then we went out and we started the protest. 7 minutes in, the Secret Service was there.
Wow.
And I have to say, you have to understand. So the word for Secret Service in Arabic is mukhabarat. And in Syria, if you say the mukhabarat is here, I swear to God, it is more frightening than saying, it's the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they come in, Opel cars, Opel stations, white Opel stations. And when everyone in Syria, when you see that car, you're like, holy shit, I need to run. And we ran, and then we got caught, 8 people, including myself. I was thrown in prison for 2 weeks, but 2 weeks were enough for me to lose 15 kilos. It's the best diet you can get ever have. I'm advertising for diets here in Syrian prison.
Syrian prison diet to laugh and cry, mate.
15 kilos. I got both my arms severely broken. My wrists were smashed. My ribs were broken.
That's kind of a downside to the diet.
Yeah.
Jesus.
I'm glad that I can laugh at it right now. I mean,
it's amazing you can laugh at it. This is one of the things about
this
you.
Is
me and you when we hang out. We joke. I mean, I don't know why I should even be doing it.
Because you're sick. Because I'm sick in the head.
No, but Hassan treats it all with this sort of
you have to beat it with laughter, with sarcasm. Back then I couldn't, but now that's how I do it. So my leg was broken, electrocution, beating. We were stripped off our clothes.
Man.
They peed on us. They spat on us. And as I was being beaten, that's like the moment that struck me so hard. As I was being beaten to breaking all my bones, the jailers were saying, "This is what you get for working with America and Israel." And I'm like, you don't get it. I'm not working for America and Israel.
So they just thought you were a proxy.
Exactly. You are a traitor. This is what you get.
What do you think? When people here on the left say that, parrot that
sort of stuff.
Like, oh, the revolutions in Syria were just proxy CIA wars, all that kind of shit.
Oh my God.
How does that make you feel?
It really infuriates me when I see people on the hard left being like, everything in Syria that's happening is imperialism. It's America and the UK and MI5 and MI6 and the CIA trying to expand into Syria, not getting it. Mm. They don't understand it.
So disrespect to that movement that you talked about, which is...
Obviously, you know, 500,000 people have died in Syria.
Yeah, to them, obviously,
and
as well.
Honestly, yeah. And so what for you to say that what happened in Syria in the first 2 years, especially in the first 2 years, it's the Americans getting involved into altering Syria and another American stronghold is completely, invalid.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because it's really problematic. You know, now we live in this time of alternative facts and, you know, different people's narratives and confirmation bias, and particularly not even just the hard left. I mean, some very prominent members of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn himself, the Stop the War movement.
Oh, my God. Had a massive row with Stop the War Coalition.
Yeah, well, you actually went in once, didn't
you? They were protesting the Trump. Remember when Trump bombed a Syrian...
sent them the missiles. What were they? Yeah, Scuds. No, what were they?
Yeah, the American army bombed the Syrian airport, military base, and from that same military base, by the way, it was where they bombed Idlib using chemical weapons. Mm. This is a Syrian army base that has been like responsible for killing hundreds of like thousands of Syrians, and the Americans bombed it, and we Syrians celebrated that.
Mm.
We didn't celebrate Trump. Mm. We know, I mean, we are technically banned from going to America. Right. So we know that Trump isn't a big fan of us.
Yeah.
But for us, literally, we got to a level where even if if Israel bombs Assad, I'm going to applaud that.
Yeah.
Israel is our, like, they've occupied Golan Heights for a long time now. But for even if they bomb Assad, we're celebrating that. Because any bombing Assad regime or bombing the Syrian army means less Syrian civilians will die.
So what they were protesting Stop the War Coalition outside number 10. You went down to number 10.
Yeah. And I was like, give me the, they, and I was like, listen, I'm Syrian. I live in the UK. This is a protest about Syria. Can I say a few words? And they were like, oh, no.
Something that really fucks me up about that is, like, I was part of when Stop the War Coalition first started, I was nailing placards together against the first anti-Iraq war marches. Mm. And I was really like, yeah, this is an amazing movement. Mm. And I went down there and I was helping to organize it. I was so enthused. And the fact that it's now become this really depresses me. I just feel so frustrated that people can't see
the difference.
I mean, the difference.
People in the West lost hope in foreign intervention in the Middle East because of Iraq.
Yeah.
Because of what happened in Iraq. Because we know now this whole Iraq war has been, I mean, it shouldn't have happened in the first place. It was made on false allegations that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. And then Britain and America got involved, causing like one of the worst civil wars in history. 5 million Iraqis were killed. So because of that, Stop the War Coalition is saying that we shouldn't get involved in Syria. But hang on a second. Getting involved in Syria isn't the same as getting involved in Iraq. When you get involved in Syria, you are basically saving, you know that Assad, I mean, the world has satellites monitoring every little movement in Syria. They know what's going on in Assad dungeons. They know how many people were killed in bombings throughout Syria, Aleppo, Idlib, the countryside of Syria, countryside of Damascus, Dara. They know how many civilians were killed in chemical weapons. Mm. So getting involved is actually a human thing here.
Mm.
It's not imperialism. Mm. It's not like destroying another Arab country. It's basically saving civilians. It's saving
Tony Blair really
human lives.
Us and you and everyone. The fallout from that war is just still not finished.
I don't think you can possibly even look at it just as fallout. I think these things are absolutely causally linked.
That's what I'm saying. I feel like we're still feeling the effects of that.
Yeah.
He's feeling the effects of that. The entire Syrian population suffered because of a war he started in two other countries nearby.
Well, let's be clear, because, you know, actually, I actually was interviewing Alistair Campbell recently, and we only had 5% of the forces. You know, it was at 95%, you know, an American war, which we justified. And according to a new book that Gordon Brown has just published, there was an entire dossier which the British government had very, very little information on.
Yeah.
But I actually think it's less about the political dynamic in terms of whether the government thought they should get involved, and more about this very distorted type of isolationism that the West has sort of... Because on the left, you're right, it's this cocktail of conspiracy and everything is interlinked, and it's almost like Illuminati stuff, isn't it? Going back, way back to 9/11 and everything like that. But on the right, it's, well, actually, we've got our own problems. Mm. We're going to look after ourselves.
Yeah, that's true.
So, dude.
Yeah?
You might remember I mentioned this to you the other week, but do you listen to audiobooks?
Yeah, I do.
Well, we, I think, were telling you a couple of weeks ago about
Richard Branson autobiography.
The Rich Brant's autobiography, Finding My
Virginity.
It's from Penguin Random House Audio, and it's been published as an audiobook. So, you know, this is the sequel to his first autobiography, Losing My Virginity, which released in 1998. And this is an audio title of him reflecting on 5 decades, really, of being a leading entrepreneur. After setting his stuff up 50 years ago, you know, pretty honest by all accounts. It's not just about his successes. I think he, you know, goes into talking very much about difficult experiences he's encountered.
So probably sort of thing you might read for sort of business tips.
Yeah, if you're in a business community,
if you're a business person, you want to get some tips and some experience.
I mean, Branson is, you know,
he's one of the leading entrepreneurs in the country.
Really is. And this, however, is not actually read by him. If you want the abridged version with Branson himself reading it, that's coming out later in the year. This is by Steve West and by Bites. He's voicing the book. And that is the version which is available right now from Audible. Just to say, guys, we're not going to do the 3 courses today. We're just going to be talking
Fuck
about
it.
Syria.
We're just going to
the whole time.
Hassan's the main and only course.
Yeah, exactly.
Just to clarify, in 2012, when us Syrian activists were demanding for intervention, our idea for intervention wasn't to set any boots on the ground. We did not want anyone in the West to send any soldiers. Because I know, and we understand that people in the West don't want any foreign intervention. They don't want to send their boys to die in a war that they don't understand. What we wanted, we had our own Free Syrian Army back then. They were in control of 70% of the Syrian ground. What we asked for is no-fly zone, which could easily be done, and like safe zones for civilians. That's what we asked for.
Through evacuation or within...
Exactly, right. So we know, like, for example, we can, through evacuation, so UN would just announce if no-fly zone over Syria, because most of the Free Syrian Army collapsed because the regime and the Russians, they have control of the Syrian air zone. And that's how the Free Syrian Army collapsed.
Which, just to be clear, this is what happened in Bosnia.
Yeah,
okay, this has been
absolutely
done before.
The
no-fly zone was policed by the UN. UN generals and commanders were basically ordering any hit that did happen on the ground.
Yeah.
And it was all went through the UN.
Yeah,
that was the process.
Yeah.
And
that's
it has happened before.
Yeah.
There's precedent for this. We can do this. It doesn't always have to be fucking America and the UK going solo.
Unfortunately, we don't learn from history. I mean, history repeats itself, and we don't learn from our previous mistakes.
So hold on a second. You're in jail. I mean, I know part of this story, but I want you to tell it because it's just incredible. Like, you're in jail. You've been tortured in this awful, awful way. This is incredible. You're brought in front of Assad, right?
So because I was a teacher back home. I taught at private schools where elite families and army generals used to send their kids. And my students were like, what happened to our teacher? And then when I got out, I went back to school and I was still like, I was literally like, you can tell that this guy has been through shit.
Yeah.
My story went viral. Everyone was talking about it. And then even the president, Bashar al-Assad, knew about it. So I went to meet him. He asked for me to go and see him. So I went to see him and I just...
It must have been terrifying.
Oh my gosh. it was terrifying. But still, I don't know. I mean, I don't usually have big balls. I mean, I'm not literally speaking here, but I'm like, in general, I'm not that courageous, but I don't know how I got the audacity just to tell him everything straight to his face.
You just told him everything?
I just told him everything.
That happened
I was like,
to you?
Yeah, everything that I've seen. I was like, I saw torture, I saw rape. And these are like college kids, you know? These are people that you can easily talk to and like have a conversation with. But I told him that everything, his policies are like ruining the country even more. Ruining his image even more. I was like, I hated you a tiny bit, but I went to prison and I was like, I can't stand you right now. I almost died because of you and your soldiers.
Weren't you terrified that he was going to
execute you
or something?
I started the conversation, was like, do you want me to say the truth? And I have to say, he was like, just say the truth. And I was like, am I going to go home if I say that? He was like, yes. So I just told him straight to his face, everything that I've seen, everything that I've witnessed.
How did he respond?
Oh my God, he's so manipulative. He started saying that it's our fault. There are channels to say that. I was like, what do you mean there are channels? You even assign MPs.
He's got a point though, Hass. You know, you get 10 minutes and as long as there's no more than three of you, you can there do whatever
are,
you want.
In Syria, you have to understand also, there are no political parties except for the Ba'ath Party, which is like the ruling party. MPs are assigned by the Assad regime, by the secret police. So I was like, what's my medium? How do I deliver?
I didn't know that. Like, I've known you for a while. I had no idea that you actually looked him in the eyes and you like told him what you're doing. I mean, that is putting yourself in unbelievable peril.
What happened to you after that?
Hoping that I would, I mean, the reason I did it is hoping that I would have a conversation with him and change his mind. Like, because I was like, this is from a Syrian to a Syrian, from a man to a man. Just listen to me. Let's have a conversation. Let's come up with a solution. But he doesn't know that he's basically butchering Syrian civilians.
Oh, so he doesn't realize
He is fighting terrorism. He is fighting insurgents. They had a word for us. It was called Mundes, which means like a traitor or insurgent. Mm. So that's always been the case with Arab dictators, is that they would butcher their people in the name of fighting Israel.
But
they're like, we're defending you from the Israelis. I'm like, no, you are killing me.
I suppose they have to believe it. I mean, you'd have to. Otherwise, you would break down.
Exactly,
you'd go mad. And it's just a psychopath.
It starts with the educational system, by the way. Because I studied in Syria. I went to Syrian schools. From the cradle, you are taught that this is a country that is fighting imperialism, fighting foreign intervention. And we have to do whatever we can do in our power so we can defend this.
Yeah.
Even if we...
So you indoctrinate.
Exactly, we're indoctrinated. Really, yeah. It is propaganda. You're fed from the cradle.
Let's talk about the journey itself, so, when you decided to leave.
Also, to clarify, because a lot of people don't understand this. Mm. The population of Syria is 25 million, right? Half of the population now has left.
Wow.
But when we left, we didn't come to Europe. So people started leaving as early as 2012. Mm. It wasn't 2015 when the first dengue started arriving into Europe. We've been leaving for a while, right? But our idea was that we're going to stay in the region because we still had that hope that the crisis will be over soon. They're going to get rid of Assad. We will go back. Hence, people stayed in Turkey, 2 million. Lebanon, 1 million. Smaller than Wales, by the way, Lebanon. Has 1 million Syrians.
1 million refugees.
Yeah. Jordan, 1 million. Mm. Iraq, imagine, 500,000. Sudan, 400,000. So we stayed around. And that's what I did. In Egypt, I stayed in Lebanon, stayed in Turkey. Right, okay, we're gonna go back. It's gonna be over soon. Mm. And we were still assisting abroad as much as we can with the people who are still in Syria.
Mm. So this myth that the right has about, they just wanna come here
no,
and take
I
on.
No, we don't, honestly. Yeah. I mean, I'm not, with all due respect to Europe and Britain, is Britain still Europe?
I don't know.
Well, it isn't until, apparently I was just literally reading, it's something
I don't
like
know what
11
to say.
p.m. on the 31st of March, 2019,
there you go. All right.
The Brexit clock gets hit.
All right.
So until then.
So we're still Europe. So it's not like Syrians or Arabs or Muslims, we were born and they're like, we are fed, listen, you're going to grow up, you're going to go to Europe or America. No, this is not
what?
It.
What? I'm in shock. So hang on, all Muslims aren't terrorists and they don't all have beards.
Hold on a second. I thought you were told you're going to go to Europe, hang out in that incredibly luxurious camp in Calais for a few months,
yeah.
drinking
this
champagne.
And then come and steal our benefits, get a free house. Okay.
Steal our BAFTAs.
Exactly. This is not the case. We're not born and like ordered immediately to go to Europe or to go to America or whatever. We don't want to come.
Yeah.
Honestly, no matter how awful Syria was, run by secret police, no liberty, no freedom, nothing, but still it's home.
Yeah.
You know? And there's nothing like home. I mean, London is great for me, but it's nothing compared to Damascus for me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it was up until 2014, 2015 when people were like, this is not going anywhere.
Mm. So where were you?
I was in Turkey.
You're in Turkey.
And people...
Whereabouts?
In Istanbul.
In Istanbul.
So I am...
How
again,
did you get to Istanbul?
There is this hierarchy. I flew from...
Right.
I flew...
So you were allowed to get out?
Yeah.
Okay. So they weren't stopping people to leave Syria at that point?
No.
Okay.
Go ahead. Flee. Because they wanna... That's what happened. The people, the activists, the people who are against Assad,
so they were like,
people like me,
off.
What happened to them? Some of them, high percentage, got tortured to death. Some... left like me, and the rest are stuck in refugee camps in Turkey and Lebanon and Jordan. Feeds on my survival's guilt, is because I had enough money to live in a camp,
right?
Because the people who are less fortunate than me, the Syrians who had less money, people like who are poor, they've been in refugee camps in Turkey, Lebanon and Jordan for the past 5 years. And I did not want to do that.
That's an entire life for a child, just wasted.
And unfortunately, the people who came to Europe are the people who can afford paying that much for their journey. They sold their properties, obviously, sold their houses. Imagine selling your house, a place that you've, I mean, what, you've spent ages building, to give that money to a smuggler to get to Europe.
I think that is one of the least understood facts about immigrate, quote unquote, you know, migration, and that obviously it costs money to get to get across oceans, to pay traffickers.
Did you notice, by the way, I mean, just to speak about that, did you notice how people were like on Twitter in 2015, oh, why do these refugees have smartphones?
Yeah.
Or some of them are wearing, like, they have the
fucking stupid. People think what? People in Syria. They come from the 1850s.
Yeah. We're all beggars. So that's the myth. If you're a refugee or you're a migrant, you have to be poor. You have to be living in rags. But you don't understand that I'm not fleeing because I'm poor. I'm not coming because I want to get the £35 that you get as a job seeker's allowance in Britain. I'm not coming for that.
You're not coming for that massive, massive paycheck.
Coming for our BAFTAs.
I have to say, you know, I don't think it's very different from, you know, quote unquote benefit scrounger. You know, like the false consciousness, you were talking about the education system, you know, that the right wing press has kind of, and it was happening for years before Syria.
Yeah.
You know, it was just this image of a Middle Eastern Arab who is a terrorist.
He's a terrorist jumping out of a lorry.
And they're a danger to you, and they're coming for you, and they're going to. And then, you know, you read these staggering statistics, like, you know, one of the places that has the most fear of immigration is Cornwall, where there's no immigrants.
Yeah.
Because there's this existential fear.
Do you
want
to go to Cornwall?
No. I wouldn't want to go.
It's coming for St. Ives Beach.
Why is that happening?
I mean, it is beautiful up in Cornwall.
Yeah.
Anyone up there?
Let's go to Cornwall, Hassan.
Yeah. I would love
to go surfing. Realise all their fears.
Yeah. Because every other day there is a cover on the Daily Mail, on the Sun, something about immigrants, or like immigrants are taking our jobs, or immigrants are causing so much terror. That's the thing that happened in Britain that strikes me, is that the NHS is crumbling, Brexit has literally fucked up the world, the government is failing, police cuts and everything, but always fingers pointed at immigrants.
Mate.
Dude.
What would you do if you were looking for a business?
Mate, I would...
Say a hardware store in your local area.
Get out a divining rod.
No.
Eat some biscuits.
No.
Mate, would I look for a website?
Yeah, you go online, you Google local hardware stores and you'd find the website. If you're a business and you don't have a website, you're missing out.
If you are a person who looks at websites, then you're just like everyone else, and every day millions of people go online in search of local businesses.
When you create a website on WordPress.com, you make it easier for your customers to find you, to connect to you, and to hear how you can help them.
Does your small business even show up? If it doesn't, you need a website, mate, and WordPress.com can do that for you.
It can do that for you. You don't need much experience, any experience, in fact, in setting up websites, because WordPress guides you through it from start to finish. It's super simple.
Do you know, the thing that seriously I think is amazing about this is they take care of all the technical stuff, so it's easy for you to get up and get a site sorted.
Exactly. I don't know how to do websites. I can barely do podcasts.
They've got a customer support team, bro, made up of WordPress
people like
experts,
me,
eager to help you all of the time. They're available 24 hours a day, Monday through Friday, and weekends, damn it. And weekends, 24 hours a day.
That's pretty damn good, actually.
So plans start from just $4 per month, and all WordPress plans include a custom domain name for the life of the plan.
No way.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Go and see why. Check it out. 28% of all websites on the internet run on WordPress. Do you know that? 28%.
That's an absolute madness, thinking about how many websites.
That's a lot of websites.
So listen, get started today with 15% off for our listeners on any new plan purchase. So go to WordPress.com/roast to create your websites and find the plan that's right for you.
That's WordPress.com/roast for 15% off your brand new website.
WordPress.com/roast. Don't be a ninny. Get your 15% off. There's something that I've kind of always wanted to ask you, which is, you know, obviously, I have seen that footage that Hayden was talking about, where you've got a GoPro on your head.
Yeah.
Right? Which I've always found amazing. But then in my mind, I was a bit like, well, that's a good thing to focus on.
Yeah.
I'd prefer to think about that than drowning. But what is the experience like of crossing an ocean?
It's terrible. It is quite terrible, because suddenly you are demoted from a human being to cargo. When you are go on that boat, we are treated as cargo. People smugglers using weapons, they count people, we're given numbers, and then we're chucked on boats. Our boat should have taken only 45 people, but they put 63 people on it because they're so greedy, they want more money. Each person paid $1,000. And it was a huge business. Billions of money were made, poured into the wrong pockets because Europe didn't deal with this crisis properly. Mm. People should have been resettled immediately from Turkey and Lebanon and Jordan and not had to pay all that much money. On the boat, I mean, what did I do? I packed my life in my rucksack. And it was that funny like moment when you're like, what do I take? And like the most precious items that I can remember, like I have, I took them with me. And then 20 minutes after sailing, our boat sank, as people saw in the documentary. Mm. And it was so shit, honestly, just seeing this. And I want people, if you're listening to this, and you guys to imagine it happening to you, literally. Imagine you're going on a dinghy from Dover to Calais, right? This war started in the UK, God forbid. I'm not saying that I want a war to happen here. But like, imagine if it happens the same to you. And then you would sympathize. Then you would understand what is it like to go. Imagine like going on a boat with your mates, people that you've gone to school with, people from like Hackney or Shoreditch, you go to Shoreditch house with. And then you're suddenly on a boat with them. Because that same happened with me. People that I went clubbing with, people that I went to school with, people I used to run with. And then we're on a boat and the boat is sinking. You're like,
kids
fuck.
On it.
Exactly.
Families.
Kids and women and men. And there was university professors on that boat. There was engineers, there were teachers, there were like just random people. There was even a belly dancer on that boat.
Even a belly dancer?
Yeah.
So for people who haven't seen the footage, tell them sort of what happened.
The boat, 20 minutes after sailing, just starts sinking. So it's so shocking. And even your psyche wouldn't want to approve that this is actually happening. Mm. You're in a state of denial. You're like, is this really happening? Mm. Like, what's going on? Mm. And then I was like, fuck. I was filming because I filmed because I wanted to show people what it's like to flee home. And for a personal reason, I mean, I've got PTSD and like all sorts of shit. And I get really stressed out in these situations. So for me, it's an escape. I was like a filmmaker. I wasn't a refugee fleeing war. Mm. So it was really helpful to do that. And the boat sank. And then there was a woman who was pregnant. She had a miscarriage on the boat.
Jesus
and it's just
Christ,
witnessing
man.
All of that. You're like, you literally give up on humanity.
Do you know what I love about Hassan? Probably the most, right? Is that he's like, yeah, no, I mean, I just get really stressed out in those kind of situations. Like a boat sinking, bro. It's totally fine to get stressed out.
But what he's like, what he's not saying is that he saved the boat because he was WhatsApping his friend.
I WhatsApped my
friend.
And
he geolocated where he was and they sent the Turkish Coast Guard that came to pick him up.
That's basically what I was asking him to sort of like take the hero mantle. Like, no, you're not going to do it. Okay, fine.
And it's literally what you do, for example. Imagine like meaning like you want to see a friend in Soho, let's say, and you're like, what do you say? You're like to them, like drop a pin on WhatsApp, right? That's exactly what I did.
Which pub are you at?
I messaged my friend Hiba in America, and if you're listening, Hiba, thank you again. And I was like, listen, we were sinking, and I don't have the numbers. I'm gonna drop you a pin. She's like, all right, drop me a pin. So I dropped her a pin. And then she phoned the Coast Guards and they sent a boat.
Isn't that just incredible?
That's amazing.
Like technology, the way that...
And that,
in a way, is one of the things that kind of gives me hope for the future and stuff like that. Because I think just an individual talking to another individual saved you and a
and
number
also
of
the
other
technology
people.
That he used in order to make the film
exactly.
to show people what's happening.
Yeah. What are the things that you think are the biggest myths that still are poisoning the way that, you know, Syrians are seen in the UK and that is basically poisoning our politics here?
Yeah. Again, a lot of people here complain about Syrian refugees. The UN announced yesterday that the UK has resettled 7,000 Syrian refugees so far from the Syria region. 7,000, right?
Of a population of 12.5 million that have fled the country. That's
exactly,
fucking disgraceful.
Yeah,
it's an absolute disgrace.
And Britain, by the way, 1 million people arrived in Europe 2015. 0.5%, I think, of them went to Britain. Britain isn't taking migrants, isn't taking refugees. This is one of the biggest myths that people think is like people want to come to Britain or people like they have this dream of coming to Britain. It's not true. It is literally not true.
And there's, you know, footage, archive footage of 10,000 child refugees arriving before the Second World War into Dover, and there's footage of like 70,000 people arriving in Southampton before. I mean, like there's precedent for this. We shouldn't be this closed-minded, cruel,
well, this is the key.
Is
what has happened, and what has happened is the inflammation of the right-wing press and this sort of vicious. I mean, for me, of all of the sort of despicable headlines in the Express and the Mail, the thing that really got me was those pictures of not even Syrians, getting out of the back of a van on the front page going, oh, is he even a kid?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck it. Is he a kid? No, he's not.
Same, yeah.
And then an MP saying, I forget the Conservative MP, check their dental
check
records.
Check their dental records.
Do you think that there is something? Because obviously, we're friends. And empathy is a big part of our lives, doing the various things that we do. What has happened to empathy? Mm. Like, where has it gone?
Absolutely. Again, I started this with saying that Syria is one of the most well-documented crises in the world. And people know, you go on your phone and you can see what's going on in South Sudan. You can see what's happening in Myanmar, Chad, Syria, Afghanistan. Mm. So when you watch that footage, when you see these daily explosions, people being butchered and killed, and how come when you see that, how come you don't understand that people instinctively, they want to flee and they want to find a safe haven temporarily until their countries are safe enough for them to go back?
Yeah.
Empathy just, I feel like it all goes back to, I mean, for me, I feel like it's racism.
Do you know what else it is? It's, and this is the other thing, it's the power of context. You see, if a bomb goes off in the UK, then the newspapers will quite rightly tell you who they were, mm-hmm. who their loved ones were, what they did. We'll show probably pictures in the paper of them. If you look at even Grenfell Tower, the victims were not contextualized. You didn't really have many stories about who these people are.
Yeah,
and then it's difficult to empathize. You know, when a terrorist attack happens, and I think it's very difficult, and I find now, certainly speaking to people who are more right-wing than me, they say, yeah, but you're ignoring the fact that people are killing people with vans. And I try to say to them that, look, the thing that worries me the most is that these psychopaths are given so much press.
Yeah.
And
that's what they want.
Exactly.
Yeah, they want fame. They want to, legacy.
Exactly. Mm. And it's these kind of aspects that, you know, we don't really talk about, that are at the heart of empathy and what it is. Because if you don't understand someone's life, then how can you really connect with them, you know?
Yeah.
And again, there is something very dangerous that have happened in the past couple of years, is dehumanizing migrants.
Exactly.
It's very dangerous, by the way. When you say on the news, or when you say on a Daily Mail, or when like Katie Hopkins tweets, what is she, swarms?
Swarms,
of,
yeah.
Yeah, your
final solution, swarms.
Final solution,
swarms. I would put the gunboats, I mean.
Exactly, yeah.
Really, like, when you saw
like Nigel Farage in front of a big poster saying breaking point, and it was like actually migrants in Slovenia, I think, or Croatia, they're not even in Cali or in Britain. That's dehumanizing migrants and refugees. That's very dangerous, because technically, if I am someone who's like a white supremacist, when I hear that, I'll be like, I'm going to kill them then.
Do you know the worst thing is, there should be, and I'm starting to really really focus in on that, because I actually think it's incitement, it's racial incitement.
Mm. Yeah.
And I only learned this very recently, but all political advertising has absolutely no laws around it. You can literally say what you want. And if that was, you know, if I was like saying, buy a cat, and there's a picture of a dog, right? That would not be legal. Someone would be like, dude, that is a dog. It is not a cat. I'm very sorry, but you cannot tell people that dogs are cats. But it's quite okay to say, oh, that bunch of swarming people that I've said is from this country is not. So it should be outlawed.
Yeah.
This should be legislative change that is made.
But people should also, you know, it's also cultural, isn't it? And it's like, I mean, this new Exodus series, it's actually really good. Like, it's not focusing so much on the journey that the last one did. It's a lot of it's about people sort of trying to find their homes and fitting in societies and stuff like that. But it's heartbreaking, a lot of it. And like, watching that, seeing this guy from Ethiopia who's in fear of his life and can't go home and living with a strange family and just trying to put yourself in that person's shoes. It's amazing. You should watch it. It's on BBC right now.
Yeah. Is you can catch it on iPlayer. Yeah. So it's
Pass,
it's,
you should watch that show you've directed. You know what I'm saying?
I didn't direct, just to clarify.
No,
I didn't direct. Hopefully, yeah. I mean, I'll be a director soon. But if, yeah, Exodus 2 is on iPlayer now, 3 episodes. So the first Exodus was about the journey. Now, what happened to the 1 million people who have arrived in Europe? How is Europe treating or dealing with that crisis? What I really like about the second Exodus is it's not just Syria. Because also there's this myth, it's like refugees only come from Syria. It's also from Ethiopia. It's also from Afghanistan. That's also, there's a hierarchy in the refugee world, because people sometimes favor Syrians over Afghans. We had 6 years of war. Afghanistan had like 4 decades of war so far.
Completely. There was a total hierarchy when you went to these camps in these places. You saw it. And also,
you see it, yeah.
Something actually that isn't mentioned, which I think is really important, and it was brought to my attention by 2 German women in Kos that were helping out the refugees. They said to me, you know, the group that is actually treated worst out of anyone in the refugee crisis, men.
Yeah.
And like, this isn't something that's popular to say, but like, I went to camps in Kos and all over Europe, actually, where the only people that were left in these really horrid, squalid places were African men.
Yeah.
Like, the Syrians were prioritized for good reason. Yeah. But, you know, there's not necessarily a full-on civil war in Nigeria, but there's a fuck of a lot of fuckery happening in Boko Haram in the north.
Yeah.
And if you're in fear of your life,
Chad district,
and you're, right, then you're going to leave.
Absolutely.
And, like, I guess it makes sense, of course, like, send the women and children first. But then you've got these camps with, like, 100 African men, no food, no running water, just no sanitary, just absolutely disgusting.
Yep.
No one gave a shit.
You're totally right about the dehumanization. Again, one of the big things that struck me when I looked at the map of the jungle in Calais was, oh, look, pretty much every... And just to explain, obviously, you know, there was an Afghan area, there was an Eritrean area, you know, there was a Sudanese area, obviously a Syrian area. And it became pretty quickly, but, you know, I did politics and international relations. I did dissertations, you know, on Islamic extremism and, most importantly, US military interventions, British military interventions. We have had a hand in the destabilization of states and
so
regimes.
Read like a map of every country.
Of military. You know, it's
like
amazing to think, but when you start dropping bombs, people run away. And, you know, unfortunately, our foreign policy has an awful lot to answer for. Now, quickly, before we finish the podcast, we all want to tell you a bit about Help Refugees, which is a charity that Hayden helped found, that Hassan has been an intimate part of. And let me just tell you from a personal experience, I can be really, really honest here. I was actually terrified of going to the jungle. I was very worried because I thought I was going to be I don't know how I'm going to deal with this afterwards and everything. It was one of the most humbling experiences of my life because I met inspirational people, people who had been tested. And in my life, I haven't been tested. I haven't had to cross an ocean or a mountain. And let me tell you, when you meet those people, they're incredible, inspirational characters.
As an outtake for this podcast with Hassan, I think probably the best thing, I don't know if everyone agrees, to do would be to donate to Help Refugees. It's helprefugees.org. It's all pretty simple. You go on the site and you donate. Like Jolene was saying, it's more than just a charity. It's like a movement of people that are kind of giving their time for free often in all sorts of places around the world to help the situation. Genuinely, all of us have seen what it's like in these big camps, and we've seen the kind of ineffectual behaviour of a lot of the major NGOs and charities. And I think we can all bear witness to the fact that Help Refugees isn't like that. Help Refugees is genuinely trying to help people. And if you do anything having listened to this podcast, please donate to Help Refugees.
But it doesn't have to be money. It can be your time.
Yeah,
To tell us just really, because obviously we've got limited time, but what's been your human experiences of dealing with these volunteers? How's that affected you?
So it restores your faith in humanity because you've gone through a lot of shit in your life, and then you are in a camp, and then someone who doesn't know you but doesn't care who you are, where you come from, but knows that you need help, and then they're giving you a jumper or like just some food and or even like listening to you and like chatting with you. That's something that's really actually helpful. It makes you feel better about life. And people think that the refugee crisis is over, not knowing that Calais is building up again. There's like over 1,000 people. There are 60,000 people in Greece. There are people on Greek islands that have been there for 18 months. Winter is coming. People need clothes. People need coats. People need sleeping bags. And I am an ambassador for Help Refugees, and I know the amazing work they do on the ground. And as Hayden said, and as you said, Julian, it's really important that you help. If you can't give money, you can sign up to volunteer, or you can get involved in any of their...
I would genuinely almost prefer people volunteer, because when you go and you meet people,
I think you speak to Josie Norton, who runs the charity, like, they're in desperate need of money right now.
Really?
Really desperate need of money. Because, like Hassan said, everyone's forgotten that this is still a thing, and people are focusing on other things, you know?
Brexit.
There's a lot, everyone's stressed, and, you know, it's difficult, but, like, Help Refugees really needs money right now.
Yeah.
So if you could do anything, it'd be amazing.
It only leaves it to us to thank so much our guest, Hassan.
Thank you for having me.
We've loved it. So, you know, please, if you've enjoyed this podcast, you know, rate it on the iTunes store. We really love making this series. This is almost the end of the second series, and we're going to need, you know, your reviews and your ratings if we're going to get a third series, because we've got some fantastic guests we want to come on. But Hassan, we'll definitely have you back as well, man.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Hassan, for coming on.
Yeah. Bye, guys.
Bye.